This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. A few years ago, our guest today was on this program to talk about her memoir, 365 Nights, a memoir of intimacy. That appearance was all part of a book tour which took her to the Oprah show, where she had an epiphany, and not a pleasant one. It was that single moment that led to big changes in her life, her body, and her psychology. It also led to another book, which talks about that experience. Pretty Takes Practice, A Real Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty, may sound shallow, but readers have described it as the perfect guide to aging gracefully and unblinkingly honest. Charlotte Muller is a local Charlotte author, and she is back with us for the hour to share this latest and transformational chapter in her life story. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Although I wasn't here the last time you were here with Chris Clackham, who's
with Chris,
who fills in for me from time to time. Well, I apologize for
that. That's okay. I missed you.
For being out. You know, there are a lot of authors, big name authors, who never make it on Oprah. And you did. You've been on Oprah and on The View. Obviously, that's because of the titillating subject matter of your last book. I'm not going to talk a lot about that last book, but it is about your promise to your husband to provide him with intimacy for 1 year every single day.
Correct, yes.
Did the women at The View, and who was on The View with you that day, by the way?
Everybody. It was the full cast. So it was Whoopi Goldberg, Joy Behar, Elizabeth Hasselbeck, Barbara. You know, Barbara Kate isn't there consistently.
Right.
And the rest of the crew.
Okay.
So it was the full group.
So what was their take on this? Were they astonished at this? What was their take on it?
You know, it's really interesting. Sherry Shepherd was on there too. Sherry Shepherd and Elizabeth Hasselbeck were both on the show, and I would consider them more kind of my contemporaries in terms of kind of ages and stages. And they really, I think, understood the premise of the book, which was kind of an intentionality around marriage and intimacy. And I was a little bit more nervous about Whoopi, you know, because she can come out of left field, so to speak. But it ended up being Barbara Walters who really threw a couple zingers at me that day. And, you know, it's live television. It's very surreal. And that group tends to talk over each other a lot. So
what did Barbara say?
Oh, she asked, you know, very, very kind of bold questions about things that happened behind bedroom doors, which the book certainly didn't touch on. And so you had to be kind of prepared to cover that.
Well, Barbara's been pretty forthcoming about her own.
She certainly has. And it's interesting that you should say that, because about that time was when she had come out with her own kind of autobiography. So I think that there was some intersection there possibly for her.
I think she was trying to take the heat off herself and put it on you.
I think that's exactly right.
So what was the result of the promise?
Well, it was the most transforming year of my marriage, without a doubt. And it really didn't have anything to do with what happened behind closed doors. It was everything that happened in all the other aspects of my life. And that was really what the book was about. I found that committing to that aspect of my marriage really lifted everything else up. And that was really what I wanted to share, and that was really the intent of 365 Nights. But you're right, it is kind of a titillating topic, and so I was thrust into the spotlight.
Well, a lot of people, men and women, I think, would find that promise daunting and maybe somewhat tiring or even distasteful after a while.
Possibly see all of the above, yeah.
Yes. How did it turn out for you and for your husband? How did it turn out for the two of you? Did you do it? Were there intimate moments? I don't know how you say this on radio.
Sure.
But were there intimate moments every day?
Well, the intent of the gift was every day, and then there were some basic kind of ground rules around that. And we delivered, you know, nearly every day. I mean, if one of us was out of town or my husband occasionally travels. But I think that the most powerful part of the year of the gift, as we euphemistically called it at our house, was the intention and the priority that we gave it. And at the end of my husband's birthday was on July 3rd, so on July 4th, the gift ended. And so, you know, it was this kind of symbolic Independence Day for me.
Were there fireworks?
For me. And I remember being really happy and celebratory, and my husband was a little bummed. And I said, really, would you want to do this again? And he said, you know, intimacy every day for a year is not a long-term sustainable model, but neither is intimacy hardly ever. And we had lived out both of those extremes through the course of our 10-year marriage, and I think that we had tripped over something that was fundamentally important for our relationship.
Now, I have to ask, was this a gift? Did the idea start as a genuine gift, or did it start as, I'm going to make this offer, And as a result of this offer, I'm going to write a book.
No, absolutely. No, it was definitely the former. Never in a million years did my parents think I would write a book about this. No, I had no idea how to write a book or have the intention of writing a book. In fact, we embarked on the year, so to speak, and I never really shared it with a whole lot of folks until I was maybe a third of the way through it, Mike, and I was also having these conversations with my girlfriends, you know, about being married and being a working mom and having young kids, and I realized that we were having these very rich conversations about how we were juggling all of these priorities and that I wasn't necessarily the only one that was figuring out how to prioritize or rather reprioritize things in my life, and that was one of them.
Now, that obviously, that book led you to network television, which
yes.
led to this book,
yes.
Pretty Takes Practice, A Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty. And it was your moment on Oprah mm-hmm. that led to this epiphany that we'll talk about as we go through here. Oprah, you were not in Chicago for
no.
Oprah. You were on Skype for Oprah.
Yes.
And I asked you before we started how that worked, because most people on Skype sit in front of their computer with that little camera at the top of the screen and look into this nasty little computer mm-hmm. camera, and it looks like, well, to put it in an NPR term, crap.
Mm-hmm.
they send you a kit. The Oprah Show sent yeah. you a kit that you set up in your living room.
Yes.
What was in the kit?
Well, it was pretty much all of that equipment. I think they wanted
but a better camera.
But hopefully a better camera.
And microphones.
And a microphone, yes.
And you just hook it up to the internet mm-hmm. and you're off to the races. I mean, did they send a makeup artist in the kit?
No. I wish they had.
Did they send lights in the kit?
No. We took the lampshades off our lamps.
And that was in the instruction manual, right? Take off your lampshades. Did they tell you to put the roses behind you, behind your left shoulder?
Did they
tell you
to do that?
Because there's always flowers in the background.
There's always flowers. Maybe that would have made a difference, Mike.
Because you write that you looked, because when you're doing this, you can see yourself on television. And you saw yourself on the big screen that used to be behind Oprah.
Correct. Exactly right.
Now, having done television, I will tell you that lighting is crucial. It is critical. It is the key ingredient. It is the most important thing, followed by makeup, okay? And when you see yourself on a big screen behind somebody else, mm-hmm. it's even worse. You saw yourself on this screen with bad lighting mm-hmm. and no makeup artist, mm-hmm. and you thought, and it was horrific for
mm-hmm.
you.
It was pretty painful.
But that's not fair.
Well, I'm not sure. Well,
it's not a good test.
Real life, I don't get lighting and professional makeup either.
No, but television, first of all, TV puts 10 pounds on everybody who sits in front of the camera, period. It just does, because it flattens you out. Secondly, without lighting, you look, I'm telling you, I know this, you look awful.
I did. I looked pretty bad, and it was kind of a troubling moment.
Did nobody tell you this?
No.
Before, during, or after?
Well, after I saw it for myself, and then afterwards, you know, you continue to get feedback.
But that's not you. That's bad lighting and bad camera and on Skype, coming back to you from Chicago on a big screen behind Oprah. It's just not a fair test. But it did lead to this book.
It did lead to this book. So it led to some good things, I'd like to think.
Well, now, you also went on The View.
Correct.
That was live. You
yes.
were in New York
yes.
with the women on the
yes.
set. Same feeling.
I had.
Did you have makeup artists?
I had makeup artists. Sat, you know, went into the little makeup room with Whoopi Goldberg, which was kind of campy and fun. Yes, I mean, you get makeup on The View. We did the Today Show, and we certainly had makeup there. I never watched those.
And great lighting.
Mm-hmm. But I never watched any of the interviews. The only one that I ever watched was Oprah, and it was because I had to. It was kind of part of the interview process.
Had you watched the other one, the book might not have come out.
Had I watched the other ones, the book may not have come out. I've never thought of it that way.
So you saw yourself on Oprah, and what happened?
I really was sad, in a way. What I saw on the screen was not kind of the image of myself that I had in my head. And
But isn't that always the case? Don't you look at yourself in still photographs and go, that's what I look like? Really? That's what I look
certainly,
like? Happens to
certainly.
Me almost every day. Who's that old man with the paunch? That's what I think when I see myself in photos.
It was less about, wow, I look older, but more about that's not what I had put on weight. And I actually say in the book, I had on a what I thought was a really cute black sweater from Stein Mart. And I was like, I'm wearing a sweater from Stein Mart on the Oprah show.
That you bought 5 years before.
Yeah, yeah.
I do have to ask this question.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
I was trying to look thin. I was wearing black, Mike. I was just doing whatever I could.
This is Oprah, and you're wearing a sweater from Stein Mart.
But it was black, and it was, you know, I was hoping, yeah. There was a little bit of strategy there, but it was kind of a defining moment for me.
You're wearing a black sweater today?
I'm wearing a black sweater right now. Yes, I am.
So you were on there. You hated what you saw, and you actually hated the experience of being on television. And you told me before we started that being on Oprah was actually easier than being on The View. Mm-hmm. Why?
Well, the women on The View, and we all know that that's part of their kind of premise of the show, is that there's a lot of talking over each other and kind of a lot of debate, and so it's hard. You know, the book had a very specific point of view that was oftentimes misconstrued, and so it was hard to be in that group and really articulate with, you know, six other very strong-willed women what the book was and what the book wasn't. So
did Elizabeth Hasselbeck give you a bunch of stuff?
No, she didn't give me a bunch of stuff. Okay. No, no. Okay.
She's known for that.
She didn't.
So your new book that came out of this epiphany, like most books today, has a subtitle. And the subtitle is A Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty. Mm-hmm. Why Southern Woman? Does that put you in a particular category? Does that help sell books elsewhere in the country or here in the South? What's the deal on that?
You know, that's a great question. I feel like I have a possibly distinct point of view due to my heritage and the fact that I'm from the South. We originally, when I was chatting with my editor who's in New York at Berkeley Books, that didn't necessarily play into it. And she was the one who really said so much of what you articulate is through the screen of, I think, growing up in the South. And it was really her suggestion to do that. And I think it could possibly be limiting if there are people who aren't necessarily interested in a Southern woman's point of view. Although I do think that themes around beauty and aging and appearance are universal.
Sure. But I'm, you know, just putting that without opening the book, and you look at the book and you see this woman in a black and white polka dot dress touching up her lipstick, and it talks about a Southern woman's search for the real meaning of beauty. Is that putting you in a stereotypical category for the rest of the country? Because the rest of the country looks at the South in a particular way, and it's not always attractive.
But it's not always unattractive either.
Well, we're known for beautiful women, but usually beautiful women with lots of makeup and big hair.
I'm thinking about how much I like big hair. I don't have big hair anymore, but I had some big hair back in the 80s. I love big hair.
Didn't we all?
You know, I think that that's part of the conversation. You know, I do think that certainly we can say that there are regional differences in terms of how we tackle beauty and aging, and certainly Southern women possibly get a bad rap for over-investing in that part of their being. But I think it adds to the richness of the conversation, and I'm okay with it.
Okay. You describe yourself as a Southern woman through and through, a woman who is trained in appropriate grooming and sound fashion habits, training you adhere to in a semi-relaxed manner until Oprah and your other network TV appearances, where your attitude about appearance was transformed. We'll talk more about that and about some of the other things in this book as we go through the hour here. Charlotte Muller is our guest. She's a Charlottean. Her book is called Pretty Takes Practice, which many people will take issue even with the first part of that title, and we'll talk about that as well. Stay with us. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Business North Carolina magazine, covering the economy, industry, and business of North Carolina each month. August features the state's top public companies with subscriptions online at businessnc.com and at the App Store. You know, youth sports has changed a lot since most adults today were children. Back when they were kids, they played whatever they liked to play. I mean, if you liked baseball, you played baseball. If you liked football, you played football. If you liked them both, you played them both. And you played them at different levels on different teams. But today, the trend has been towards specialization. Find a sport that you like and play it till you get really good at it, until you get that college scholarship, or go pro. Well, now the thinking is shifting away from that. They say that hyper-specialization of sports can actually hurt kids. And we'll talk about that tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new study says 35% of Americans are facing debt collection. Now government regulators are taking a closer look at how the industry operates inside America's debt collection industry.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte talks with Mike Collins on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Miller is our guest. Pretty Takes Practice is her new book, A Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty, which goes into a lot of different... She has 12 rules about all this, which we'll talk about. But this came as a result of being on Oprah and The View and other shows for the promotion of her first book, and she didn't like what she saw coming back to her on television. Before we talk about all that again, I want you to start with the very first page of the book. You start writing about us, the pretty Queen City, in a way I doubt that many people have written about us before. And I want you to do this because your being on Oprah opened up a Pandora's box of insecurities. This closes, this opening page will close a lot of the Pandora's box on our own insecurities in the Queen City, because you are remarkably complimentary about us.
Well, it is my hometown.
Well, go ahead and read it.
Sure. I live in a city that is bright and glossy, with modern skyscrapers that glitter and twinkle, seeming to invite you to join in the polished success of our fair metropolis. Pretty and freshly renovated houses sit perched on wide, tree-lined streets and beckon you to daydream about their finely appointed interiors. Gorgeously landscaped yards boast perfectly placed azaleas, magnolia trees, and crepe myrtles, and bid you to come lounge in their shade. Shiny new SUVs, smart cars, Mini Coopers, and luxury sedans buzz around town to appointments, meetings, carpools, bridge, tennis matches, and in those skyscrapers, houses, yards, and cars are very attractive, well-groomed, and nicely dressed women who took the time and the energy to get pretty. Pretty girls are everywhere in my town of Charlotte, North Carolina. Case in point, my girlfriend's best pal visits annually from New York City, the world's epicenter of all things sleek, chic, and au courant. And what can she say when it's time to leave the Queen City? I can't wait to get out of here. Everyone is so damned attractive, it bums me out. Don't I know it, friend? This town is ruining the curve on pretty. When one is a really very average middle-aged mom living in a city where pretty reigns and grooming is high art, looking put together and feeling pulled together can be more challenging than pumping and freezing 6 months' worth of breast milk in a feeble attempt to bulletproof the immune system of my babies, who are now sneaking full-leaded soda from vending machines.
You know, when you talk about, and I've had friends from New York say this, almost exactly that, I have to leave because I feel ugly. Because, you know, they attack the world differently. If you have to live in New York, then you have to, there's other things you have to think about.
You have to be armed in a different way, right?
Absolutely. And we have the luxury, I suppose, of being more relaxed. And yet you've lived here your whole life in North Carolina. And you knew this about this, and you have this, as you say, Southern woman's training through and through of being appropriately groomed. Were you not appropriately groomed before this appearance on Oprah? Did you realize suddenly that you had let things slide?
Yeah, I'd let things slide. I'd fallen off the grooming wagon. I mean, I think it all happens as women. I think we go – I think that part of what this book explores is really kind of figuring out where you want to spend time and energy, and we have a lot of priorities, and oftentimes beauty fell to the bottom of the list for appearance.
But you knew and you had been taught that first impressions count.
They do.
And my God, you're going to be on Oprah.
I thought the black sweater worked, Mike. I don't have anything else to say. I mean, I think fundamentally we all know what we're supposed to be doing. We just don't do it.
But seriously, if you're going to be on Oprah or The View or any national thing where you're going to be in front of millions of people, those first impressions do count, and you should be put together, I would think. I would think anybody would want to be, although I've seen people on those shows who are not. Obviously, it doesn't matter to them. But not everybody gets to be on Oprah. So if you're not on Oprah that day, what difference does it make?
I think it does make a difference. I think it makes a difference in how you feel for the day and how you choose to put yourself out there. It doesn't mean that every day has to be, you know, a stylized day of dressing to the nines and going out with a fully coiffed or fully presented. But I think that what I discovered through this process was that I needed to try harder. And so it caused me to do some kind of personal introspection around where the role that I wanted beauty and appearance to play in my life. And it takes time. I mean, there's a chapter called Looking Good Takes Time, so yeah. Find some. And I had not been taking the time.
What was I going to say? I forget. It's a great question, and it's not coming to me anymore. Oh, well, too bad for me. I really don't know what the question was. That doesn't happen very often. You didn't like what you saw on television. Here's the question. You didn't like it, but then afterward, you heard from people.
I did.
Now, people on television, particularly women on television, know this to be true, that very often, whatever the content they bring to TV mm-hmm. is overshadowed by the lipstick that they wear or the way they did their hair that day or what they wore that day. And that's what people want to talk about. Mm-hmm. And usually it's in a negative way. Mm-hmm. Or if it's not, it's like, where did you get that brooch? I want to get that brooch. It's not the fact that they're talking about nuclear proliferation and how to save children from Ebola virus. It's who did your hair? Right?
Absolutely.
So was it your seeing yourself on television, or was it the feedback, the brutally honest, mm-hmm. sometimes net catty of feedback that you got?
Certainly both. I mean, certainly a little bit of both. And I had been getting a little bit of the feedback along the way, prior to Oprah. And I was amazed. I mean, I was a little bit naive. I mean, I'm not a career television mm-hmm. person, so I was fairly unprepared for the feedback that I was going to get around what I looked like. I thought that with the first book, as naive as it was, that people would either think it was campy and interesting or that they wouldn't care. But it was very important for people to know and to see what I look like with this first book, because it ultimately I think staged in people's mind how credible my point of view might be around the first book. And it was, case in point, before my New York editor signed me, she asked in a very nice way if she could see a picture of my husband and I. And she later told me, you couldn't be too pretty. Because if you're going to write a book about, daily intimacy with your husband and you're some 6 foot tall, willowy blonde, people are going to be like, of course, look at her. She's fabulous looking.
Right. So the book contract was predicated on what you looked like.
I'm not sure it was predicated, but that played into it. And that was kind of the first part of this journey. Whether I like it or not,
right.
It doesn't matter whether or not I pay attention to it to a degree. Other people are paying attention
to
it.
Looks do matter. First impressions certainly matter. And you say that our ideas of beauty and appearance help us make order of our lives. How so?
Well, the witch is always kind of, when you think even about story fairy tales, you think about the heroines are always attractive and lovely and kind. And, the spinsters who've never been, who've never been married or the mean old school teacher is, I think that we, whether or not we know we're doing it, appearance and beauty help us make order of our lives. And oftentimes it plays into how we interpret things.
But beauty is in the eye of the beholder. There are a lot of people walking around who think they're beautiful, and they're not, at least to me and perhaps to others. But as long as you think you are, so what?
Well, I think
if you're happy, that's all that matters, isn't it? I mean, if you look,
I think that's a true statement, Mike.
Okay, all right. So if beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and beauty does change from person to person, it changes from era to era, it changes from society to society, how do you put a label on it? How do you say that's beautiful?
Well, I think that for the purposes of my experience and the purposes for this book, my definition, and there's a lot of different ways to define it, or my definition of pretty is really internal and external. And that's really what the book focuses on is I saw myself, in high def, was a little horrified, knew that I had to do some work on the outside. But I would suggest that work on the outside and work on the inside are inextricably linked. And so I didn't just do work on the outside and didn't just focus on presenting well to the world, because I had some inside work to do. And I think that's what this book is all about is, your grandmother's saying of pretty is as pretty does is true. And so I think that there's a broader definition of pretty, which is putting your best forward. And that requires some of the internal work too. I mean, we've all met people who look polished and beautiful on the outside and not so much on the inside. And I think that that's where the real interesting work for us comes in, which is what part are you going to own about making sure that you're putting the best part of who you are forward? And the outside is just one piece of that.
Okay. You've laid out your book into chapters, and those chapters are correspond to 12 rules that you have about being pretty. Beginning with looking good takes time, so find some.
Yes.
Prior to Oprah, you had a busy life. Mm-hmm. You paid, quote-unquote, enough attention, or so you thought to yourself, which all changed after your epiphany. But why do you have to be dolled up all the time? I mean, and when you say it, being beautiful takes time, so take it, are you taking time for makeup? Are you taking time to make sure your wardrobe is coordinated? Or are you, what are you taking time for? What takes the time?
I think it depends on who you are. I mean, my mother always, I grew up with, my mother's beautiful. I grew up thinking my mother was beautiful, and this, as a quick sidebar, this book really talks about those themes of kind of what we knowingly and unknowingly inherit from our mothers. And I grew up with my mother saying, you know, Charlie, you're short and you're high-hipped and you're always going to have to get clothes-hemmed. And that's just, and that was part of her helping me understand it's going to take time for you to find clothes that fit well on you. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, I don't spend an hour in front of the mirror every day, and I'm not suggesting that anyone else does either. I'm just saying that figure out where you want to be on the beauty and appearance continuum and then take the time to do that. And so I have to take time getting clothes altered, and that's a real fat chat, but I had to figure that out. I inherited my father's premature graying, you know, so I got to figure out how to, you know, my father and my brother look stellar with their salt and pepper. Me, not so much, you know, and so that's something that
I don't see any.
Yeah, you don't see any. So that's another thing. And so it's not this everyday kind of spending hours and hours every day, you know, gazing in this very self-centered way into the mirror. It's really figure out what you got to do and make the time to kind of knock it out and get it done.
You said you don't look good. Your brother and your father mm-hmm. look great with salt and pepper. You not so much, you said. Mm-hmm. That's your opinion.
It is my opinion.
That's what's important, isn't it?
I think so, yes, to some degree, yeah.
What's looking back at you, either in the mirror or on the monitor behind Oprah, that's what's important. You have to be comfortable in your own skin.
Yes, Mike, and I think that part of my definition of pretty is finding a place where we all feel comfortable in our own skin, and it's different for everyone.
But so, what if you liked, let me just ask this as a hypothetical, what if you liked yourself with salt and pepper hair and somebody came up to you, your friend, your husband, I don't like that so much. Why don't you dye your hair? Would that have any cachet, or would you stay salt and pepper because you like it?
I think I'd stay salt and pepper because I liked it.
Okay, I'm just testing you.
Yeah, no, I think I would. Well, there's a little segment in the book where I talked to my hairdresser about putting one of those dramatic white streaks in the front because I think those are like so distinctive and all that kind of stuff.
They are.
And he really counseled me against it. And so I went to like Ulta and bought like this little thing that you clip in your hair, and I was going to kind of test it just to see if I could start to go white a little bit more. And yeah. Even I agreed it wasn't quite a good look.
Chapter 2 is called Size Matters. You write that, like it or not, weight can be a defining factor in who we are and what we become. I long ago realized, you say, that carrying extra weight is like losing one of your five senses. It heightens all the others. In the absence of skinny, one must compensate. How so?
Well, I was heavy for a long time, and while I kind of knew it in the back of my mind, again, the national television moment really kind of brought forth the fact that I was heavy. I've struggled with my weight for the better part of my life, and I did feel the need to possibly compensate because you're not necessarily standing out because of your outward appearance, or maybe you're being singled out because of your outward appearance, but not necessarily in a great way. So you do kind of compensate. I was oftentimes the funny girl or the witty sidekick. And
where does that come from? Did you feel you had to be funny to take people's attention away from your feeling that you were overweight? Or does it come from the fact that you were particularly uncomfortable. So in order to be liked, despite of your overweightness, you had to be the witty one. Where does that come from?
I think for me, it was a little bit of a defense mechanism and staying a little bit, kind of trying to stay ahead of that.
So, do you think you needed to do that, really needed to do that? Do you think people would have accepted you had you not done that?
I don't know.
Didn't want to find out, did you?
I didn't. Well, you know, it's interesting. What crafts humor and wit in a person? What sort of life experience crafts that? And oftentimes,
Comedy comes out of pain.
Comedy comes out of pain. So yeah. Yes. But I think I'm richer for it in a strange sort of way, if that makes any sense.
Well, you can keep the humor.
You can keep
with
the humor,
or without the weight.
With or without the weight, and hopefully without the edge. You know, yeah. I mean, certainly there was. You know, with humor comes out of pain, and there's a little bit of an edge to that. Yeah.
So you lost 60 pounds.
Yes.
I hope you don't mind me talking about that.
No. you can just go watch some television clips and see.
but we live in a society where 1/3 of the population, 78 million people, mm-hmm. are obese. Mm-hmm. In our society, does it matter that you're 60 pounds overweight, really, when everybody else is walking around and you can feel the earth move?
Yes, it does matter.
Why?
You know, so here was the interesting part of my weight loss 5 or 6 years ago. It was the first time that I had focused on my weight without an end game in mind. You know, so my weight had fluctuated over the better part of my life, and it would be things like, when I lose X amount of weight, this cute boy is going to ask me out, or I'm going to be able to interview for this fabulous job, or X, Y, and Z. I'm going to be more popular. This was the first time that I had lost weight without an end game. You know, I was happily married. I mean, I went through this whole first book experience and this 40th birthday gift at that weight. You mm-hmm. know, so certainly I wasn't saying my marriage is going to be so much better after I do this. I'm going to have more friends. There was no end game. I just knew I needed to knock that off. And I probably knew on one level that it was holding me back. And I wasn't quite sure in what ways.
Is that the baggage you talk about that comes along with having extra weight? There's a baggage you carry around, and it's not just the weight.
Yes, I think that at least there was for me. And there was maybe some baggage there. And I contend that if you're too skinny, there's some baggage there too. So I contend that living life kind of on extremes oftentimes comes with baggage. I've never been too thin, but, you know, I would suggest that possibly that comes mm-hmm. with some baggage too. I've only been on the other extreme, and I do, and it was holding me back. I think I say in the book, I was a little bit less bionic, and I didn't know how great it would feel. And it wasn't about. It was just so multi-layered. It was much more than what I would look like on the outside. The weight, more than that.
We're going to come back and talk about how to learn to own who you are, which is something you talk about in the book as well. Charlotte Muller is our guest. Pretty Takes Practice is the name of her book, and we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Unlimited Possibilities, family care home providing Alzheimer's and dementia care in a home-like environment. More info at upfamilycarehome.com. Well, a new study says 35% of Americans are facing debt collection. Now, government regulators are taking a closer look at how the industry operates. On the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, they take a look at Inside America's Debt Collection Industry. That's coming up in 20 minutes. If you'd like to join our conversation about being pretty, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks will get you to us, as will Facebook or Twitter, and we're coming right back.
You know what? It really does help to have friends in high places. basically, we pitched him in an afternoon, and he said he'd fund us to the tune of $1 million an hour later. So it was, we were very lucky in the funding early on.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. As it turns 10, a conversation from the Yelp corner office next time on Marketplace from APM.
That's Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte Miller is our guest. She grew up in Asheville. She lives in Charlotte. She has two books to her credit, 365 Nights, a Memoir of Intimacy, which brought her, not intimacy, a lot of attention.
Notoriety.
Notoriety. And that led to an appearance on several of the daytime talk shows that would deal with this topic. Of course, our show dealt with it too, so we are no better or no worse. But now she's written a book called Pretty Takes Practice, and it's a result of the epiphany she had while on Oprah, seeing herself on television for the first time and realizing, I've let things slide a little bit. Pretty Takes Practice, A Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty. I'm asking you a lot of serious questions here.
Yes, you are,
and
Mike.
What occurred to me during the last several answers is that what we're missing in all of this is the humor that is throughout this book. Danny Romine Powell, who wrote an article about you and this book, I think yesterday, in the paper yesterday, pointed that out, that this is really a funny, light, breezy approach to some things that can hurt and can be painful for a lot of people. And these rules that you have about helping you get yourself back together can be hard. If you follow the rules, it can be hard, but you do it in a way that is humorous. Where does that come from in you as a writer? It's not easy to be funny on paper.
I've always tackled tough stuff, I think, with the lens of humor and trying to kind of find a bit of the absurd in it. And sometimes it does feel absurd, right? This kind of investment that we have to give in beauty and appearance, but nonetheless, there's a certain, I think, importance to it. And so I tried to come at that. I've always been able to tell a story when it had a funny angle to it, or if I could imbue it with a funny angle. And I think it also helped me process kind of personally what sort of lesson I was supposed to take out of it. You know, so it is kind of comically tragic to see yourself on Oprah in a five-year-old, you know, black sweater from the discount store, if you choose to interpret it that way. So I think sometimes, you know, kind of wit is you mentioned it earlier, is a possible defense mechanism. I think in many ways for me, it's a survival mechanism. You know, so how do you process through some tough times in your life? And I, not that this was particularly tough, but, you know, those bumps on the road are a little bit more manageable, I think, if you look at it through a lens of wit.
One of the things that you talk about is learning how to own who you are. On the one hand, you're talking about how to be better, how to look better, how to be prettier, how to take more time with your appearance because first impressions count, et cetera, et cetera. But on the other hand, you're saying, well, learn to own who you are and what
Absolutely.
You look like. Is there a dichotomy there?
I don't think so. I think that's part of the inner work that I had to do. It was owning who I was and being at peace with who I wasn't. And I think that comes with maturity too. I think, you know, I'm in my 40s and I think that that's been a really nice time to kind of accept this is who I am. This is who I'll never be. And then building from that foundation and who do I want to be? And I don't mean that from an exterior standpoint or from an external standpoint. What do I want to put forth in this world? How does my faith play out in my life? What sort of mom and parent and, do I want to be? How do I want to inform my kids' lives in a positive way? And all of that, I think, comes together and puts forth to the world a certain impression.
You talk a lot about your mother in this book, and you have a chapter in the book called The Mirror Doesn't Lie, and Neither Does Your Mother.
She doesn't. Your mother doesn't lie.
But earlier in the book, and you get to that chapter later in the book, you talk about having lost this weight, and you're about to go out to dinner with your mother and your husband and your sister-in-law and I guess
her
husband,
right?
And you put on this white wraparound dress, something you have not been able to wear when you were heavier, that with the black piping on it, and you think you look stunning.
I do.
And you, and because you haven't been able to wear this kind of a style before, this is a watershed moment.
Right.
You walk downstairs and your mother says,
gosh, why are you wearing that? That's too nice to wear out tonight.
So you immediately, like a 12-year-old.
Totally had a 12-year-old adolescent moment and ran upstairs to my bedroom and pouted and got very indignant about it.
Ripped off the dress, threw it in the heap. It's a linen dress.
Yes.
Threw it in the heap and starts to change. And then your sister-in-law comes in.
And says, you looked great in that dress. Put it back on. Let's go. Like, roll with it. And Right. Yeah. I think the mother-daughter dynamic is so rich and interesting, and I think that that was a perfect example of mothers and daughters bruising those tender spots that we have in each other that we probably don't even know about. And she was bumping up against a tender spot that she didn't even realize she was doing. My mom would never do that to intentionally hurt my feelings.
So if your mother never lies, what is the lesson here, that she never lies, but she still may be wrong?
Well, I think the intent of the chapter, The Mirror Doesn't Lie and Neither Does Your Mother, is that I grew up with my mom really trying to help guide me on some things. And I did, you know, struggling with a sturdy physical disposition. She was trying to help me out growing up. And there were some moments of kind of honesty that I didn't want to hear. And as an adult, I was able to circle back and go, you know what? My mom was right. And I think that it's important to acknowledge, you know, certainly we shouldn't do everything our mothers necessarily tell us, particularly as adults. But I think that the intent of that chapter is, I got a lot of good feedback from my mom that I probably didn't pay a whole lot of credence to because I wasn't emotionally mature enough to give it the appropriate attention. But as an adult, I was able to circle back and say, you know what? She was really right about this. She was really right about that. I should have listened more to that. And also, she was passing along, I think, some nuggets of wisdom about appearance and taking time from her screen, and we look a lot alike, you know. So there's also kind of all of that emotional stuff kind of wrapped up together as you look at the person that, in many ways, I'm probably going to look a lot like her.
Well, you say, and it's true, that mother-daughter relationships can be tenuous at times, and particularly when you're younger. And I suppose some of the way you as a daughter react to your mother's comments as a child sticks with you in your subconscious as an adult, either positively or negatively or both. But now that you know this about yourself and you write about this incident with the dress, what is that doing to what you say and how you say it to your daughter?
You know, I'm really trying to be intentional about that because I have this lovely daughter. She's 14, and I'm really trying to, you know, help guide her. And I do think that appearances matter, and so I want to help guide her, and I want her to own, you know, how she feels about herself in a really wonderful way. But I'm definitely using my own life experiences for better or for worse, and so I know I'm messing it up a lot. Because I think we do as moms, but I'm trying, and I'm really hopefully coming from a place of intention. But it's tricky. It's just a tricky journey to process kind of who you are and what you want to own about beauty and appearance, and then not give it too much weight with your daughter. I mean, I want her to think that she is absolutely wonderfully made. But at the same time, you know, you got to take a shower and wash your hair.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Is this concept that pretty takes practice and looking nice being important, is this retro? Because I'm old enough to know, to remember a time when at Thanksgiving, for instance, if my family had people over or we went someplace else for Thanksgiving dinner, we got dressed up. We wore jackets and ties. I don't know that my father ever owned a pair of sneakers, ever. I mean, he would mow the lawn in leather loafers. Very dangerous thing to do, actually.
Probably, yes. You know, I'm thinking about it. My father's – I've never seen my father in a pair of blue jeans.
Exactly. Right. I did not own a pair of blue jeans till I was in college.
Really?
Yes. Never had a pair. And when I first got into this business, we wore ties on the radio. I mean, no one saw them.
Isn't that funny?
But we wore ties on the radio. I mean, and we came dressed because appearance was important. Today, people come in T-shirts on the radio. I mean, sometimes not even that. Except unless the dress code at your office requires it. You look at people sometimes and you think, you go to work like that?
Right, right.
So obviously we have changed our point of view on this.
Certainly, I think there's a more relaxed dress code today in any situation. I think what you're talking about is more of a formality. I think that there's something to be said for taking the time. I mean, what?
Well, women do. If you walk downtown if you walk in this town on that street behind us here, College Street behind us, which is the bar row on Thursday, Friday, Saturday night.
I hadn't been there in a while.
If you look, the women are dressed to the nines, and the guys look like they just finished mowing the lawn.
Now, that's kind of interesting, isn't
and
it?
And I just find that fascinating.
What do you think that's about?
I don't know, but you write about this thing in your book about your husband going to an event where he was the guest of honor, and it was a picnic, but you criticized what he wore.
I did.
Because he went very, very informally. Is it a girl thing to be pretty? I mean, and to be well-kept and to be dressed up and dressed appropriately for the occasion? Did the guys miss that memo?
Possibly. And I think you bring up an important distinction. I think there's a difference between being dressed up and being dressed appropriately. And I think that my point with Brad all those many years ago was are you dressed appropriately for this occasion where you're the guest of honor? And you know, I think, again, that's something that I think I may have inherited generationally. My dad saying, you know, dressing appropriately for something is a sign of respect for the people that you're going to be with. And it's an indicator that you want to be there and that you are delighted to be invited or happy to be a part of the occasion or the event. And so I think I must be carrying that through in some ways. He always used to say, too, it's always better to be overdressed than underdressed because you can always take off the tie.
My father used to say that.
Yeah, there you go.
Always better to be overdressed than underdressed.
And don't you think there's something to that?
Yes.
And what do you think it is?
I think it's respect for the event. I mean, even if you come to a party and you're the guy in a coat and tie and everybody else is in a polo shirt or a T-shirt and jeans, it means this event and you. Mm-hmm. Are important to me. So, okay, I'll take my jacket and tie off and get cash.
So you took time. You know, you took time to kind of think about it, which is a little bit of what one of the chapters talks about.
What is that about with us? Why do we not do that anymore?
I suggest that there are still folks that do that. Yes, absolutely.
Dress the part is what that's what you're talking about. Are you talking about that, or are you talking about who you are and who you want to be perceived as? If you dress the part, you'll be more successful at that. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think there's a little bit of – I think that there are a couple different themes in the chapter, dress the part. And, you know, you used to always read in business books back when I was starting my career, you know, dress for the job that you really want, you know, kind of thing. And there was always kind of all of these edicts and guidelines around that. And so I think that there might be a little bit of that in there. But I think dressing the part is paying attention to where you are in your life right now, and if you're a professional and you're a working mom, are you paying attention to that? And there's a great story in there about my sister-in-law, who's an investment banker, who, you know, had these interns that she was trying to groom, and just their inability to kind of show up professionally was really kind of getting in their own way. They were getting in their own way. Right. And so I don't think you should overinvest in dressing the part or try to suggest that you're trying to dress the part of someone that you're absolutely not, but don't let that get in your own way.
And it's not just being beautiful. It's not pretty or even handsome. It's not just about clothes and makeup and hair and grooming.
Absolutely not.
It's about manners. It's about demeanor.
It's about graciousness. It's about putting others first. It's about, I think, you know, really kind of trying to be a person of substance. And that seems so contradictory, doesn't it? I mean, I recognize that. I know I'm gonna get slammed on that a lot because the whole idea of pretty in appearance feels so shallow and cliche. But I just suggest that the internal substance work correlates with the outside stuff too, and it all works together.
I want to go back because you talk a lot about how to be pretty and how to groom properly and taking time to be pretty, etc. But you also learn how to own who you are and what you are, and learning to be with peace with what you are not and what you're not going to be. You've obviously reached that point. I would think you've reached that point.
Aren't we all a work in progress, Mike?
Okay. Any tips on how you might get there? And how you know when you're not selling out or just being lazy. Well, I'm never going to be that way, so I'm not even going to try. As opposed to trying, how do you reach that point?
Well, I think you just kind of have to ask yourself some hard questions. And the book, you know, doesn't have any guidelines or rules. I do not know how to make someone else. I don't know how to do makeovers. I don't know how to encourage other folks to kind of go through transformations. The book is really stories and anecdotes of kind of tripping through this experience,
right,
and really pulling, you know, including anecdotes and stories from growing up as kind of an awkward, clunky kid, and having to process through all that, and really using that as a jumping off point for who you become as an adult. I think that being at peace with what you're not comes with age and maturity and some life experiences. I think that being at peace with what you're not is, again, a lot of inside work in addition to the outside work. I'm never going to be a 6 foot tall, willowy blonde. Yeah, that's pretty obvious. I'm never going to be a runner. I don't run, you know. So when I talk about, I have a really funny story in there about how I don't run, and all my roommates when I was living in Charlotte ran all the time. They ran marathons, and I really just, I'm not a runner. I need to be at peace with that.
I have an email from Nancy who says, today's interview is great, but I want to make sure that your listeners understand Charlotte. She's smart and successful and respected personally and professionally. She is captivating when she tells a story. I would consider Charlotte a true Southern woman who has the loveliest manners, and I want to emphasize that prior to this book, I never thought Charlotte appeared sloppy or looking like she needed a good scrubbing. The takeaway from the book is that taking care of yourself is important. First impressions do matter, but she makes you laugh, she makes you cry, and in the end, she makes you think about how you want to project yourself to the world. Congrats, Charla. I think you're fabulous.
Oh, that's so nice. Thanks, Nancy.
And we'll end it there. The book is called Pretty Takes Practice, A Southern Woman's Search for the Real Meaning of Beauty, and it's funny, too. Charla Mueller,
thank you
for the hour.